if you're looking for real consequences and arrests, it's got to come down to DOJ. Merrick Garland's failure to bring the real criminal charges is so pointed because these guys know that you're just playing patty cake when it comes to Congress and contempt and misdemeanors and things like that. But when you start talking about seditious conspiracy, which I think applies here, and meaningful obstruction of Congress, that's a little bit of a different ballgame. But if Merrick Garland's sitting there twiddling his thumbs on the sideline, no one's going to be deterred from anything.
Welcome to episode 84 of the Refuse Fascism podcast. This podcast is brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of this show. Refuse Fascism exposes, analyzes, and stands against the very real danger and threat of fascism coming to power in this country. In today's episode, we're sharing an interview with Ellie Honig. Ellie is a senior legal analyst at CNN. Author of bestseller Hatchet Man, How Bill Barr Broke the Prosecutor's Code and Corrupted the Justice Department, and host of Up Against the Mob podcast. I recently chatted with Ellie, a former federal and state prosecutor, to get his take on the January 6th investigation, the Department of Justice, and the assault on the rule of law. But first, let's talk about some developments from this past week as they relate to the continued fascist threat. The trial of three white men who murdered Ahmaud Arbery, an unarmed 25-year-old black man who was out on a jog through Brunswick, Georgia, on February 23, 2020, is now underway. Only one black person will sit in the jury to hear the case against Gregory McMichael, his son Travis McMichael, and their neighbor, William Bryan. This is taking place in Glynn County, where more than a quarter of the population is black, and a case that is unequivocally a modern-day lynching. The judge, Timothy Walmsley, acknowledged there was intentional discrimination in choosing the jury, and then gave the racial composition of the jury, 11 white people and one black person, the green light, refusing to reseat 8 black jurors. Here is what attorney for the Arbery family, Benjamin Crump, said in his conversation with Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! On November 5th when discussing the case. Quote, "It's very disappointing, Amy, not only for Ahmaud's mother and father, but for everybody who's been following the case. The fact that you seem to have a jury that is more of the perspective, more of the commonalities with the killers of Ahmaud Arbery than the perspective of Ahmaud Arbery, this young black man who literally was killed for jogging while black. And it's troubling because the court, when they granted 24 peremptory strikes from the beginning, that was troubling because you see, they can systematically try to just strike black people 24 times. That's too many strikes. So everybody who's been looking at this case is saying that not only from the day one, when the police came out and tried to give cover for the killers of Ahmaud Arbery for jogging while black, it seems that our criminal justice system gives them cover too, when they are being brought to the Tribunal of Justice," end quote. We'll be paying close attention as this case unfolds, as it relates completely to the fascist mobs and threats of violence that are being unleashed to build the fascist movement and consolidate power. And it reflects the ways in which there is an assault on the rule of law in this country. Those attacks on the rule of law also made their way to the Supreme Court this past Monday, as they heard arguments about SB 8, the Texas abortion ban, specifically its bounty hunter element, which the law's authors openly bragged made it impervious to judicial review. As NYU professor Melissa Murray wrote, quote, "The court seems to understand that the very legitimacy of the court as an institution is in play here. And Justice Kagan underscored that, so did Justice Sotomayor," end quote. This is exactly the fascist strategy in packing the Supreme Court and the state houses. In one fell swoop, they're dismantling fundamental rights of the oppressed and remaking key, quote unquote, democratic institutions to blatantly serve fascism. After the Virginia election, everyone who's not a fascist seems to be playing the blame game over electoral strategy, but fascism's advance runs deeper. Let's talk about the Republicans' winning strategy and what it tells us. Virginia has been a focal point in the strategy of making the GOP the quote-unquote party of parents, as Jim Jordan called it. That has nothing to do with the party voting as a solid block against parental leave and school funding and spending decades cutting any benefits they can get their hands on, but on trying to control what their children are, quote-unquote, exposed to. This has come together in three major campaigns that have gone into overdrive since January 6th, trying to legislate trans people and especially trans youth out of existence, mobilizing, threatening, and often violent anti-mask and anti-vax mobs to school board meetings, and the effective banning from schools of any discussion of racism, of white supremacy. It was the last of those in particular that many credit with winning Youngkin the governorship. In one ad, a conservative activist talks about how disgraceful it is that her son had to read Toni Morrison's Beloved in high school. This mobilized the Republican fascist base in droves and helped them win a high turnout race in an important state. Some analysts have said that it wasn't the racism that won the race, but a reflection of nationwide backlash against an unpopular Democratic president, or simply a swing of the pendulum. But let's talk about context here. Where along the road to fascism is this pendulum swinging? With a party willing to unleash violent mobs to overturn elections, who stonewall congressional investigations and spent 4 years in power, undermining the rule of law here and abroad, what does it tell you that millions in a purple state are mobilized to vote for someone based on their willingness to ban books about slavery? As this week's election in Virginia show as well, Republicans don't have to cheat to win. The danger is real. That Republican legislators in states like Arizona and Georgia, Texas, erect enough barriers to the ballot and destroy enough Democratic norms that the GOP simply can't lose a race, especially if it's close. The chair of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th siege of the Capitol told reporters this week that he has signed about 20 subpoenas that will be going out soon. And while we don't know who is on that list yet, we do know that as of now, it includes no lawmakers. FreeSpeechForThePeople.org is urging Attorney General Merrick Garland to resign from his post after 9 months of inaction to hold Trump and his allies accountable for inciting the January 6th insurrection and other federal crimes they may have committed. It's a good thing that people are refusing to accept this accommodation to fascism. That said, I think it's high time for people to recognize that it isn't just one or another individual doing this, but that democratic norms, institutions, and the Democratic Party can't be relied on to truly handle this threat. As revolutionary leader Bob Avakian has aptly stated, quote, the Democrats are committed to, quote unquote, playing by the rules and, quote unquote, relying on the norms of democratic capitalist dictatorship, while the Republicans are moving to tear up those norms and rule through an open, undisguised capitalist dictatorship, end quote. As I've said before, the Republic Fascist Party has rebranded Democrats as, quote unquote, traitors. Nevertheless, the Democratic Party has proven repeatedly that they will collaborate with the GOP, or at least die trying. This cannot and will not beat back the fascist threat. It's on us. Now is the time to sound the alarm and prevent the consolidation of this American fascism. With that, here's my interview with Ellie Honig.
So today we're talking with CNN senior legal analyst, someone who's a former federal and state prosecutor, best-selling author of Hatchet Man, and host of Up Against the Mob podcast. I'm talking with Ellie Honig. Welcome.
Sam, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be with you. Given that you are a kindergarten teacher by day, I think that you will see right into my psyche as we do this.
Well, let's find out. Let's find out. I like to start big and go smaller from there into the details. You know, we've been talking about on the show with other lawyers that we've had on about needing to understand what happened on January 6th. And in the lead up to that, the slow coup, if you will, specifically the role Trump played precisely because the danger isn't over. We see Trump kind of, I don't want to say anything that wasn't like official, but it seems he's running again and doing something on the basis of the big lie. Whether he runs or not, he's definitely whipping up his followers to continue that mantra. And we saw even today, so many of the GOP young guns are people who believe in the big lie. And so less than a year later, we're still in a situation that I think that we can agree on is fraught for the state of democracy. And listeners know that the January 6th Commission in Congress is conducting hearings. Some are private, some are public, And what are some of the biggest revelations that have emerged that you think people who are concerned about democracy in this country should be paying attention to?
So, Sam, first of all, I agree with the premise that January 6th did not end on January 6th or January 20th when Joe Biden was inaugurated. I agree that it was based on a lie and an intentional lie perpetuated by Donald Trump and others around him. And yes, I believe it also will be a prelude, or people will try to use it as a prelude for whatever comes next, whether or not Donald Trump runs in 2024. And that's why it's so critical. First things first, let's just get all the facts before we even, or I guess while we think about what accountability needs to be, we have to get all the facts, and we don't have all the facts yet. When I say we, I mean we collectively. I mean we as Congress, as far as we know, prosecutors, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But as we have gotten more facts, and the January 6th committee has already uncovered some new things, and media has done a great job uncovering new things, every new piece of information we've learned has really gone towards one conclusion, which is this was part of the plan, January 6th. This was something that people expected to happen, hoped would happen, stoked along, that it wasn't just Donald Trump acting alone. He had ready and willing assists from people like Mark Meadows and John Eastman, this lawyer who we're learning about now, and Jeffrey Clark inside the Justice Department. I mean, the list of accomplices is getting longer and longer. And so I guess that brings us to, there's two main ways where we're going to get answers and accountability here. One is Congress, and two is prosecutors. Congress has done a good, not great, but good job so far of getting answers. They've been fairly aggressive in who they've subpoenaed. They've gone to battle on Steve Bannon. And now this week, we're going to see the battle over the documents at the National Archives. Keep an eye on that, because that's going to be really crucial. The January 6th committee subpoenaed documents from the National Archives, which would house all of the documents from the prior administration. And we now know, we just learned the other day from a new court filing, some of what those documents are about. They are documents by and about the inner circle, Trump, Pence, Kayleigh McEnany, Mark Meadows, Stephen Miller. They are handwritten notes, call logs, daily sort of minute by minute diaries of what the president does. These documents are going to be so crucial. Now there's going to be a court battle over them. I'm fairly confident that Trump's going to lose this for reasons we can go into, but I think he has a losing legal argument. It'll take a bit of time. Courts need to move quickly here, but so far the district court has been moving quickly. They have an argument actually 2 days from today on Thursday, the 4th. And I think the ruling will come down within a week or so of that. Then we've got to go through appeals and all that. So that's step one. The problem, I shouldn't say the problem, but the limitation with Congress is all Congress can really do is make findings. They can write papers and say, we hereby find this and issue a report. But if you're looking for real accountability and consequences, Congress can't do that. They can refer things over to the Justice Department all day long, but there's no magic to a referral. I mean, I was a prosecutor for 14 years. We get referrals all day long from everyone as high as Congress to just a, you know, a civilian who thinks his neighbor committed some crime on his property, you know, some minor thing. So if you're looking for real consequences and arrests, it's got to come down to DOJ. And thus far, I think DOJ has come up well short of the mark with two respects. One, the charges that Merrick Garland and DOJ have brought against the January 6th rioters have been short. They've charged misdemeanors, trespassing, that kind of thing, when felonies are, I believe, applicable to everyone who entered the Capitol that day, and I can lay out why. And there is zero indication that they're taking any kind of serious look at anyone above the ground. Obviously, the people who stormed the Capitol, smashed the windows and all that, they're the easy targets. But Merrick Garland vowed during his confirmation that he would follow the evidence up as high as it goes and wherever it may lead. I've not seen one iota of anything to indicate that they're looking in any serious way at Donald Trump and John Eastman and Mo Brooks and Rudy Giuliani and whoever else may have been involved. Now, people say, how would you know? How would you know? You're not in DOJ. Okay, true. There's a chance DOJ is doing this on the super down low with an extremely secret inner circle of people. However, the vast majority of times we would know either through reporting or through just if they were subpoenaing people, we would know. Those are public. I mean, you know, if you get a subpoena from DOJ, except for in very rare circumstances, you're free to talk about it. And the media learns about it. I mean, think about prior investigations. So there's not a single indication where ordinarily, not always, but ordinarily you would expect to see something.
That was really helpful. It made me think of a few other aspects of this story. I guess one of the questions that I've been wondering about is the public. We've learned a lot of the revelations, a lot of the facts of what led up to the day. Yes, there have been some public hearings, but a lot of it we've learned from the media through the three-part series in the Washington Post or the Hunter Walker's piece in the Rolling Stone. And is this type of journalism and the way that we're learning about this crime, which I would call it a crime, is that typical? For me, I wonder whether it's like persecution in the media as opposed to like, you know, like real prosecution, because there isn't a case happening.
Right.
Is this, you think, some way that short of Congress, there's like a building of a case?
So look, the media plays a vital role in all of this, in any wrongdoing, in any scandal. I mean, if you go back to Watergate, right? Woodward and Bernstein, two famous journalists who blew the lid off of that. So media always has a role to play. I would say that in recent years, the last 3 or so years when I've been involved in the media has really done a remarkable job of getting to the truth often before it comes out through official channels, whether it's through DOJ or through Congress. I mean, if you look back at the Mueller investigation, when that report finally came out in the middle of 2019, 448 single space pages, I remember I was at CNN when it came out and I was sort of frantically flipping through it with a whole team of journalists and reporters. And we very quickly realized we know all already, you know, not every word of it, but like there wasn't really too many new things that we hadn't heard. And that, I think, is a tribute to the great job that journalists have done. And the same goes for January 6th. I mean, if you could separate it out, I think we've learned a heck of a lot more in a heck of a lot more detail, a heck of a lot quicker through the media about what really happened on January 6th than through Congress. And we've learned next to nothing from DOJ. Now, that's not to say that the media is inherently better than Congress. It's just a different entity with different timetables, different rules. You know, Congress is a slow moving beast and DOJ is, they operate in secrecy by design. So I think the media, though, has really done an exceptional job, an extraordinary job writ large in telling the story of January 6th. I mean, you mentioned a couple of really important pieces. I know, not to shill for the home team, but I mean, we've had several major breaks and revelations coming through CNN, and that's what the media is there for. And I will add, I can't think of a major media story that's come out on January 6th that's been disproven or debunked. That happens rarely sometimes. I mean, you know, nobody's perfect, but everything that we've seen come out has been backed by documents, by video, by reliable witnesses. So yeah, the media plays a really important role in this.
Thanks for that. One of the questions that listeners have asked, and I understand that you are not in Congress, but that you might have insight on this. People talk about there's members of Congress who were clearly involved in organizing the insurrection. Why haven't they been expelled yet?
So expulsion is constitutionally available. Congress can expel its members with 2/3 of the vote. It's almost never done. But I think you're raising a very important question for me, which is how aggressive or passive, and as you can tell, I'm guessing we're going to end up on the far passive side of things, will Congress be about enforcing accountability from its own? Because if you notice that first batch of subpoenas that the House committee sent out, it was to Mark Meadows and Cash Patel and Steve Bannon and Dan Scavino and then Jeffrey Clark. None of them are members of Congress. However, there clearly are members of Congress, I don't care if you like these people or hate these people, who have direct information, who were in direct contact with Donald Trump on January 6th. We know for a fact Kevin McCarthy had a really antagonistic conversation with Trump on the 6th. Despite Kevin McCarthy's later turnaround, he apparently got on the phone with Trump and said, you need to call your people off. And Trump said something like, apparently they're more upset about the election than you are, Kevin. And Kevin McCarthy said to him, who the F do you think you're talking to here? Jim Jordan has reluctantly stammered that he talked to Donald Trump several times on January 6th. If you've seen those clips, they're ridiculous of him trying to, I think I did. I talked to him all the time. But Jim Jordan talked to Donald Trump on the 6th. Mike Lee, Senator Mike Lee, Senator Tommy Tuberville. We know for facts that those four talked to Donald Trump on January 6th at key times. So they are all relevant witnesses. And the question is, if and when they refuse to testify, is the committee going to have the guts to subpoena their own? And I think the answer is going to be no. And I think they're going to come at us with sort of mealy mouth. Well, we had the information anyway. We didn't really need it. But the truth of the matter is they just have these sort of unwritten rules of gentility, like thou shalt not press one another too hard. So I think they're going to come up short on that. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they will play hardball. Maybe they'll get McCarthy and those guys to testify without a subpoena, but I would not bet on that. And in terms of expulsion, I mean, that's just not going to happen. They're just too conservative. I mean, lowercase c conservative. They're not going to take that kind of drastic action. They don't have the spine for it or the political will for it.
Do you think that there's any action that would change that? Is it just so out of the wheelhouse that they would do that? Or is there a point where there is a line that someone would cross where they would say, oh, that is wrong, that is beyond what we will allow of leaders in this country?
That's a good question. In normal times, you know, I would say, of course. I mean, all of this stuff, if you sort of step back historically and think about all of the, if any of this had happened, if 1/10 of this had happened in 2005 or 1998 or 1984, I'm just picking random years here, but it would have been the most unthinkable, enormous scandal the country had ever seen. But our tolerance for all this stuff has seemingly just built up to the point where there seem to be frustratingly few consequences for conduct that would be arguably illegal and certainly unpatriotic and dangerous and abusive of power. What could do it? The only thing in my mind that would do it, you would need a smoking gun. In other words, you would need a recording or an email written by that person, because if a witness comes forward and says, Congressman so-and-so said to me while they were attacking us, gee, isn't this great? This is just what I planned with the president. Let's say McCarthy hypothetically would just say, I didn't say that. That person's lying. That's what everyone does. It would need to be a smoking gun. It would need to be a recording or an email. And it would need to be that bad. It would need to be, hey, Mr. President, isn't this awesome? I hope they capture Mike Pence. You know what I mean? Or something like that. And I think part of the reason why we're seeing such a pitched legal battle over those National Archives documents and over the testimony is because the revelations here have only gotten worse and worse. When people are fighting to avoid testifying and to keep things out of the public view and to cover things up, it's for a reason usually. So I'm not saying there is a smoking gun out there like that, but if there's ever going to be one, it would be in those National Archives documents or in the testimony of people who are loyal to Donald Trump to the point where I doubt they would come forward and voluntarily testify about something like that. So I think it's unlikely, but I think you would need to see a real irrefutable smoking gun.
What you were saying about what people's tolerance has become, and I'm not just talking about those who are listening, that everyday people and their tolerance, but also the tolerance of those who are in power.
Yep.
Clinging to norms and the rule of law that Trump and his gang have no desire to respect, to uphold, and are either shredding the rule of law outright or changing the law so that it fits their aims.
Yeah. One of the themes of my book, Hatchet Man, available on Amazon.com, bestseller. I have to do a plug. It's a podcast. But one of the themes of my book is that under Bill Barr and Donald Trump, the Justice Department, where I grew up as a prosecutor, was completely taken out of its norms. And Bill Barr repeatedly broke what I call the prosecutor's code, which is, yes, we have our written rules, our regulations and all that, and they're important. And he broke several of those. But Trump and Barr together, and Trump also in other contexts, revealed that a lot of our government just comes down to the good faith of the people in it. And a lot of what we do depends on adherence to norms and traditions and values. That's not to say that no norm should ever evolve. Some of the most important things that have happened in our country have been because somebody has said, wait a second, do we need to continue doing things this way? I mean, all the various civil rights movements have depended on questioning the way things have been done. But there are good norms and bad norms. And I think norms like tell the truth, for example, is an important one. Or prosecution should not be political, I think is another sort of uncontroversial one. But all of these things have been withered away. And when you see what Trump did and what his enablers, Barr very high on the list among them, did was they said, screw it. We're going to do whatever's best for us in the moment. We're going to trample norms. We're going to trample values. And we're going to bank on the fact that our institutions and our political opponents are not going to have the strength, the ability to do anything about it. Now, to some extent, there's limits on what can be done. But again, I've been critical of Merrick Garland. I think he's really come up short on that. I get that Merrick Garland wants to restore the Justice Department to sort of its equilibrium. And he's done a good job of A, he hasn't lied to the American public, good start for an attorney general. And B, he has made efforts to keep DOJ out of politics. But I argue that the problem is he's gone too far with that. It's one thing to say, I'm not going to prosecute or decline to prosecute for political reasons. That's good. And that's right. But I think every one of Merrick Garland's decisions, it looks to me from the outside as if he thinks to himself, if I do this, will it be even perceived as politically controversial, as a shot across the bow to Trump or Barr or January 6th or whatever? If so, pass. And I think he's been too passive as a result. And as a result of that, I think it's becoming more and more clear to people who were involved in January 6th, who motivated January 6th, that they're not going to have any consequences. The worst consequence they're going to have is paper. They're going to have a report written by the January 6th committee that's going to say this was horrible and these people are to blame for it. And they're going to say it's BS and it's a hoax and they'll just move on. That's not real consequence to Donald Trump and to people around him. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people have learned that lesson from Donald Trump.
I really agree. And I think that there's this heaviness of this continuing, of what this leaves the door open for and what it signals for the future of what will be condoned. And when yesterday's outrage becomes today's compromise position, becomes tomorrow's new normal. Yeah. And I think that this is extremely ominous. Thinking about Bannon for a moment, the January 6th commission finally decided, right, with the approval of a majority in Congress, only 9 House Republicans, to refer Bannon to the DOJ to be charged with criminal contempt after he refused to testify. I think he was citing Trump's executive privilege for why he doesn't need to testify. Now I feel like the DOJ is moving pretty slowly, as it seems, on whether to put Bannon on the trial for his refusal to testify. My understanding is that he faces somewhere between a month and a year for this possible contempt. But when could he theoretically go on trial? Right now, he seems to only have been motivated more to galvanize his followers, railing on his podcast, I guess it was last week, about how Merrick Garland and the FBI supposedly helped Joe Biden come to power illegitimately, totally divorced from reality stuff.
Merrick Garland wasn't even AG until after Joe Biden came to power, but
It's not about the truth. They've demonstrated that they'll take action regardless of whether an iota of it is based in reality. What is going on here?
Bannon is a good example of why this is frustrating, because think about it. The January 6th committee has now issued 5 or 6 key subpoenas to people who are obviously going to be loyal to Trump, Meadows, Scavino, et cetera. They've only gone to the mattresses, as we say, on one of them, Steve Bannon. They have not yet voted on contempt or anything on any of the other guys, none of whom apparently have fully cooperated. But they single out Bannon because he probably has the weakest legal argument, because he was not a member of the executive branch at the time, and he sort of most flagrantly defied them. But even now, the tools available to make him talk are unsatisfactory, because Congress can go to court and ask a judge to issue an order forcing him to testify. He can defy that. That's going to take an eternity. It's going to take way too long. They've gone the criminal route, which is good. It's their best option. A, we don't know if Merrick Garland will charge, but let's assume he does. Like you said, the punishment here, the maximum is 1 year, the minimum's 1 month, but he will become a martyr. Nobody will enjoy being prosecuted as much as Steve Bannon will relish it, will savor it, will fundraise off it, will turn himself into a martyr, and there will be plenty of people willing to do that. And he's going to fight this charge. He's going to go to trial on this charge. You're going to have to convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. Maybe he'll get convicted. Maybe he'll get acquitted. Honestly, I don't even know that Bannon cares if he goes to jail for 6 months or 4 months. It'll turn him into even more of a martyr and a hero. So, I mean, Congress has been fighting to investigate and exercise oversight since George Washington. But never until now have we seen a president and a former administration so willing to just say no, just straight no across the board, you get nothing, and make me. And every other administration, both parties, has it, some have been more forthcoming than others, but they've always managed to come to the table in some way that has been agreed upon. These guys are saying, what if we just refuse to play? Make me. And I think what we're learning is Congress and the courts, and even to an extent DOJ, don't really have the tools to make that. And by the way, even if Steve Bannon gets convicted, he doesn't testify. It's punishment, but it doesn't put him on the stand. The hope is that a normal person will go, gee, I don't want to go to jail. Now I'll testify. He's not doing that. And by the way, if Steve Bannon does testify, you think he's going to be honest? I mean, come on. I still think they have to pursue him. But this brings me back to why Merrick Garland's failure to bring the real criminal charges, the heavy lumber that I think applies on January 6th, is so pointed, because these guys know that you're just playing patty cake when it comes to Congress and contempt and misdemeanors and things like that. But when you start talking about seditious conspiracy, which I think applies here, and meaningful obstruction of Congress, that's a little bit of a different ballgame. But if Merrick Garland's sitting there twiddling his thumbs on the sideline, no one's going to be deterred from anything.
I was thinking about a recent piece I read on CNN. I believe that you had either written it by yourself, or it might have been one of those joint pieces. It was about Trump's effort to act now to stop the release of the archives.
Right.
And that could turn into a larger strategy to run down the clock.
Well, that's always been his strategy. My dad joke on this is he wrote the book, The Art of the Deal, but he really should have titled it The Art of Delay. He has in fact mastered the art of delay, though. I mean, look, remember 2 years ago when the Mueller report came out and Jerry Nadler was saying, we will have accountability and all this. Jerry Nadler got nothing. Donald Trump just said, no, make me. And you know how many witnesses Jerry Nadler ever got to testify publicly? One. And it was Corey Lewandowski, and it was an utter circus and a joke, because these guys have learned that it takes too long. They were in court over Don McGahn for 2 years, and he testified this past summer, and no one cared anymore. And that's the strategy here. Now, I will say, I think the courts have some responsibility here too. People act like the courts are this sort of holy oracle and we can't question them and they do it. They're going to, no, I mean, courts are just judges and judges are just humans and they need to do this quicker. I mean, the judge that has the archives case right now, Judge Chutkin in DC, has done a great job. She said argument, boom, she gave him a couple weeks argument. There's a deadline, November 12th. I mean, she's going to rule like this. Then it's going to go to the Court of Appeals. Hopefully they will recognize, I mean, it shouldn't be that hard. Judges, your honors, to recognize that when you have a case involving the legislative branch against the executive branch, the former president against the current president, like move that to the top of your pile, move it ahead of the case involving the postal truck that got a fender bend. You can do it, judges. You're allowed. You run your own, you know, you have life tenure, like do it. So the Court of Appeals needs to get this thing done. Look, I'm a lawyer. Anytime a judge gives you a deadline, even if it sounds crazy, if a judge says, I want your brief in 2 weeks, and you're thinking, I can't do that, you'll do it. You'll do it. I've complied with some crazy deadlines from judges. So when the Court of Appeals gets this case, they ought to give each side 2 weeks. Brief it in 2 weeks, this side, two more weeks, that side. 2 weeks after that, I want you in here for argument. And 2 weeks later, I'm going to give a ruling. They can do that. This isn't rocket science. So courts need to do better because, again, that's sort of a loophole. And by the way, someday the tables may be turned and Democrats may see this and think, oh, we can just drag our feet too. So courts have a job to do here, as does Congress and DOJ, to avoid the sort of run out the clock strategy.
I was wondering about the timing vis-a-vis the 2022 and 2024 elections and how that may help them run out the clock and get themselves back in the majority of Congress and the White House, you know, especially when paired with these laws that are suppressing voter turnout and that have been rolled out across the states. It's gotten so bad that someone, notorious neoconservative Bill Kristol, is demanding an end to the filibuster and voting rights legislation. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that, those connections.
I think the goal here is to drag the January 6th commission out past January 3rd of 2023, because that's when a new Congress takes over. And if you look historically, it's very likely that Republicans will control the House. I mean, Democrats have a 10-seat majority right now. So if 5 seats swing over, Republicans will take control. If you look, I actually happened to research this the other day, but presidents in their first midterm, so 2 years into their term, the party of the sitting president has gotten annihilated. I mean, Trump got crushed in 2018. Obama, same thing in 2010. Clinton and Obama both lost 50 plus seats in their first time. Even Reagan lost seats. The only exception was George W. Bush, but that's because 2002 was fairly close on the heels of 9/11, and we were all still in that sort of post 9/11 mode. So odds are high that the House will flip. And if the House flips, the first thing Kevin McCarthy does is pull the plug on that committee, if assuming he becomes speaker or whoever becomes speaker, says, all right, January 6th committee, you're done. So I think as a practical matter, they have a year and 2 or 3 months left to go. In terms of the filibuster, it's a question of political will. I mean, Democrats, I think the reluctance is it's going to go both ways. I mean, both parties are going to control the Senate over the next 50 years, right? It's going to go back and forth and back and forth. And so I think everyone recognizes that to change the filibuster is to change the filibuster. I will say that Joe Biden's rhetoric does not match up with his actions here. Joe Biden has said very, very dramatic things. He has said, this is Jim Crow 2.0. He has said it's the biggest threat to our democracy since the Civil War. Yet he's not in favor of changing the filibuster. He took that back a little recently. He said he is in favor, but I think he knows it's not going to happen because you have Joe Manchin and a few others. But that's nonsense rhetoric from Joe Biden, given his action. Because if he truly believed that it was the biggest threat to democracy since the Civil War, he would damn well be willing to get rid of the filibuster. I mean, it's like if I told you, Sam, this building that you and I are in right now is on fire. It is literally on fire. The only way out is to kick out that window right there. But I'm not willing to kick out that window. You would say, well, either you're lying or you're crazy. And so I think Joe Biden's pretty good at the rhetoric, but his actions have not matched the rhetoric. I'm not arguing for or against the filibuster. That's a political question. That's not really my purview. But I will say that the rhetoric from Biden has been hotter than the action.
I think that the question that we can and should all be asking, regardless of, not that it's a tactic, but a given political choice, like filibuster, no filibuster, is what is the danger and how serious is this? And then from there, what's necessary flows from that recognition. Mm. And I strongly agree that one's understanding, and if they're truly confronting what the danger is, then his actions definitely are not commensurate. I wanted to reference a piece that you had written recently about Adolf Eichmann and his living legacy.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. you had mentioned the white supremacist massacre perpetrated by Dylann Roof at the Black Church mm-hmm. in Charleston, and the events in Charlottesville in August of 2017. the anti-Semitic and anti-immigrant massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue and the attempted coup on January 6th of this year. And I was wondering, do you see these as isolated moments that hark back to a very scary time in history, a 20th century fascism? Or do you see this as a current and cohesive building threat?
So I had this privilege to speak with two men who are both really living history. One of the prosecutors from the trial of the Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann, which happened 60 years ago in 1961. The prosecutor, Gabriel Bach, is now 94. And the investigator, Michael Goldman, who's 96. He survived Auschwitz as a teenager. He still has the prisoner stamp on his forearm. And it was remarkable. And I talk about in the piece how two of my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. So I really felt this deep connection and gratitude to these two men. It's a video piece and an article that I wrote on CNN, which you can find by Googling. And nothing is the same as the Holocaust. I think people are a little too casual with calling people Nazis or comparing things to the Holocaust, most egregiously beyond the realm of casual. People who recently have compared COVID vaccine mandates to the Holocaust, which is beyond ridiculous, indescribably. But both of these men told me that they're worried that the lessons of the Holocaust and the Eichmann trial are still so relevant today. That's not to say that we are on the brink of 6 million people being systematically murdered, but to say that hatred very much lives on in our society and manifests itself in horrifying ways. Those examples you just gave, Charleston and Pittsburgh and Atlanta with the Spa shootings and Charlottesville. And so I think, as we say in the piece, it's so important to remember what we learned there and to not backslide. And I will tell you, it is, I guess, a little bit alarming or disheartening to speak with these men who saw the worst of evil. I mean, Adolf Eichmann is one of history's all-time mass murderers. And for them to say, you know, we're still concerned about what we saw back then. So that really resonated to me in speaking with them.
I really appreciated reading that piece and thinking about it. I had spoken to shortly after January 6th, the week that it happened. I was speaking with a survivor for an episode of the show.
Oh.
And what he does is he goes to high schools and middle schools and tells his story. He wrote a book about his experience and how he had to take over a caretaking role for his younger sister after they lost their mother. Their mother was stolen from them. And he said, he used to say that he thought that it could never happen in a country and that the years with Trump and most acutely what happened on January 6th had changed his thinking. And it was very interesting. And I hope that listeners go back and check out that episode. It was January 10th, George Levi Mueller.
It's interesting because I talked about in the piece how there are people like that guest who are wonderful speakers and speak and write eloquently about the horrors that they lived through. Two of my grandparents were survivors. One of them died. My grandfather, who I'm named after, died in 1960. So I never met him, of course. But my grandmother lived until 2008. So I knew her well, but she didn't talk about this. I write about this in the article. I realize more now looking back at it, deeply, deeply traumatized. We understood that she had gone through this thing, but her attitude was always, oh no, not reliving that. So she did towards the very, very end of her life, reluctantly agree to do one of these Shoah interviews that Steven Spielberg's foundation did. I'm grateful that there are people who are able and willing to talk about it.
I want to thank you, Ellie, for chatting with us, for sharing your perspective, your expertise, and your time with us. I want folks to go and check out his book. It is in the show notes. A link to where you can get his book is in the show notes, along with how to follow him on Twitter and all that jazz. Ellie, do you have anything else that you want to make sure that listeners know or get?
No, thank you, Sam. I'm happy to do this. Like I said, if you are a kindergarten teacher in Philly, you are doing God's work in the greatest city on the planet. So I thank you for what you do. Maybe you'll get my nephew someday. He's 2 right now and he lives a couple blocks away from you. So if you get a little boy whose last name is Honig about 4 years from now, give him extra lollipops and things.
Awesome. Take care.
All right, Sam. Thank you.
For other recent episodes that explore this topic, check out episode 77 from earlier this fall, featuring an interview with Ankush Kadori, and episode 71 from this summer, where I chatted with Wajahat Ali. There are a couple new items up at our website, refusefascism.org, including a conversation that originally aired on the RNL show between Andy Z, host of the RNL show, and historian, author, and Refuse Fascism editorial board member, Paul Street, in a segment titled 2 Separate Nations, Developments in the State of Fascism, and How That is Shaping the Political Situation. Check it out over at refusefascism.org and let us know your thoughts. We'd love to get submissions from listeners. Have something you want considered for publication on refusefascism.org? Email us at info@refusefascism.org. That's info@refusefascism.org. Before we go, I want to encourage folks to go back and listen to last week's episode, episode 83, featuring an interview with Yale epidemiologist and ACT UP alum Greg Gonsalves on COVID, public health, and U.S. mythology. This conversation has become even more relevant as the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit has temporarily blocked the vaccine mandate for big businesses. Thanks for listening to Refuse Fascism. I want to hear from you. Share your thoughts, questions, ideas for topics or guests, or lend a skill. Tweet me at Sam B. Goldman or drop me a line at SamanthaGoldman@refusefascism.org or leave a voicemail by calling 917-426-7582. You can also record a voice message by going to anchor.fm/refuse-fascism and clicking the button there. You might even hear yourself on a future episode. Want to support the show? It's simple. Show us some love by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts or your listening platform of choice. And of course, follow, subscribe so you never miss an episode. And if you really want to help the show reach more listeners, donate to help us place podcast ads. Give at refusefascism.org or Venmo us at refuse-fascism. Thanks to Lena Thorne, Richie Marini, and Mark Tingleman for helping produce this episode. Thanks to incredible volunteers, we have transcripts available for each episode, so be sure to visit refusefascism.org and sign up to get them in your inbox each week. We'll be back next Sunday. Until then, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.